as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Caspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m. and so on.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, and publishers, and this morning is no exception. I'm joined now by writer and editor Stacey Berline, and coming up in the second half hour, Louise Erdick will be with me, talking about her latest novel, The Plague of Doves. Stacey is a Los Angeles-based short fiction writer whose current works appear in various literary magazines and anthologies, including All Hands On, Carn, Clackamas Literary Review, Emergence, Onyx Review, Pearl, PMS, So to Speak, Standards, an International Journal of Multicultural Studies, and Young Wives Tales, New Adventures in Love and Partnership. She serves as a contributing editor to Other Voices and a senior editor to the new book imprint OV Books, where she recently edited a collection of stories entitled A Stranger Among Us, stories of cross-control collision and connection, and we'll be talking about this morning. Stacy, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I'm hoping you can begin by talking about the collection and how you became interested in the project.
Oh, sure. I became interested, well, I've always been interested in anthologies. I've always read anthologies. They have a permanent place on my bookshelf. So the chance to edit a multicultural anthology was really wonderful. I started championing this theme on our board at OV Books, along with the editors at the University of Illinois Press, whom we published this book in conjunction with. When I first got excited about the theme, I assumed my editing partner, Gina Frangello, would edit it. And when she came back to me and said, actually, my book proposal includes you as the editor, I was really humbled and couldn't say no. But even then, I didn't realize what a rich experience this would be for me. The writers I've been able to meet through this experience and the stories I've been able to read. We spent 2 years reading stories and collecting stories for this book, so it's really been a really valuable experience. I've always been interested in the experiences people have when they're away from their homeland, and this was a really wonderful opportunity to really, you know, really dive into that subject matter.
Mm. And what types of things were you looking for when you assembled the book?
Well, I was really looking for stories that surprised me. I was looking for stories that told me something I wouldn't have anticipated. And I was just, you know, looking for really vibrant prose that had a rich emotional landscape as well as, you know, telling a political truth.
Yeah, it's interesting because so many of these stories did tell something completely unexpected. And you usually have the experience of no matter how different people's experiences are, you know, we're united by this, you know, common thread of human nature. And a lot of these were very, very, so far apart from my experience they were amazing. They were amazing. Can you talk about some of the, you know, a couple of the ones that stood out for you in terms of what really shocked you?
Oh, sure. There is a story from Nathan Englander called In This Way We Are Wise, and it's about a New Yorker living in Jerusalem. He is a New Yorker living in Jerusalem, and it was about his reaction to an attack, the first one he experienced, and that really struck me, just the differences the character notices in the way Jerusalemites who are used to these attacks and have lived through them before reacts, and the way he's willing to run out into the streets and turn over bodies looking for the face of his girlfriend. And it was a story that haunted me for days after I read it, and just really an obvious inclusion in the book. Once I read it, I couldn't imagine the book without it. There is a story set in Paraguay where a man becomes obsessed with his mugger. You know, that was something that really struck me as original and organic. A story that was translated from Farsi called The Neighbor by Goli Taraghi. It's just so metaphorically rich and talks about the experience of Iranians living in Paris and feeling unsure of European customs and feeling a certain guilt about trying to be a part of this land that's not their native land. It was written so well and just really captured my attention and told very stark truths in a way I hadn't heard them told before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly this has always been the case, but this notion of the other and this us versus them mentality certainly hasn't gone away. If anything, you know, despite this interconnectivity of our world and the goals of globalization and diversity training, and the world feels like a much smaller place, but it seems to have gotten worse. I don't know if the enemy has changed or the dreaded other, but the mentality seems sadly to be alive and well. Is that, am I being pessimistic here, or is that kind of how you see the issue too?
Well, I feel that, but what's interesting is in my experiences traveling overseas, I felt something quite different. And so I feel sadly maybe that's an American notion. One thing I talk about in the introduction is while traveling in Indonesia, I discovered that Indonesian languages have no word for stranger. They have no direct translation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was explaining to an Indonesian man that we most often associate this word with the word intruder, he was surprised because in his estimation, the word stranger would have meant guest.
Mm, I love that.
And that really struck me. Excuse me. And that's true in Native African languages also. There's no word for stranger. That was interesting to me. And that was something I explored too. Yeah, I do feel also in traveling overseas, this book is not a political book, so I don't mean to get political, but I do feel that most people that I've met while traveling differentiate between a people and their government. They may not like George W. Bush, but that doesn't mean they don't like Americans. And I've noticed that that's not always true at home. Sometimes when we don't like the policies of a government, we tend to blame the people when most often, you know, the people don't necessarily agree with their leaders any more than we agree with ours.
Yeah, that's a nice observation. Yeah. This book brings home the importance of travel to me and getting out of our own spaces. And as I was thinking about the collection and the idea that our world is getting, you know, smaller and more connected, I was struck by where we live. And by we here, I mean you and I, both living in Orange County and sort of universally considered a place that's, you know, kind of lacking in the average in diversity here.
Right.
I sort of began wondering what this does to our perspective, you know, these gated communities and lack of public transportation where we don't interact that much with other people and our very insulated and homogenous lives. What are the consequences of that?
It's true. I think about this often. My husband and I both work at home, so, you know, we're home in our gated community all day, and we're not out in the workplace, you know, let alone out in the world most days. And I think that travel becomes especially valuable. And there is an argument, you know, that things like the internet and the immediacy of our television are keeping us more in touch with the world, but they're also keeping us at home or at our desks more hours of the day as well. And, you know, not out face-to-face with other people is certainly something I've thought about a great deal. And I think that one of the dangers of things like the internet is we tune into the things that interest us.
Mm.
This is going to make me sound older than I want to sound, but, you know, when I was very young, I think there were maybe, you know, 3 or 5 television stations.
Right.
And if you were turning on the television, you didn't always get to watch what interested you. You watched what was available. And now we all tune into the thing that suits our specific interests. So maybe we're not learning enough about, you know, the things we're not inclined to follow.
That's a good point. Yeah, and every time I leave the country, I'm just struck by how in my own head I really am. And
It's true. It's a very interesting part of travel. One of the things that I personally recalled a lot when I was working on this book, I remember my father talking about his experiences as an exchange student in high school, and he came from kind of a difficult home life, so that experience of spending a year away from home, I think, was very valuable for him, and he went to Germany for, I believe, a semester or maybe a year of his high school, and the family he lived with ran an inn, and so when he wasn't in class, it was his job to work at the inn and clean and cook for the people at the inn, which allowed him to meet people from all over Western Europe.
Mm.
And I always thought that was a defining thing for him. I felt like that contributed to his success as an adult because he had had those experiences as a teenager.
Great. That's neat. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here with Stacey Berline, editor of A Stranger Among Us. And I want to give you a chance to read from the book to sort of familiarize listeners with it.
Great. Okay, I've selected something from the introduction that I hope will work well. 9 years ago, I had the incredible privilege to visit the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Like travelers before me, I became enamored with the black mountains, the deep wooded valleys, the vision of white prayer flags bustling in the breeze. My days in Bhutan moved quickly, and I didn't want to leave. I cannot remember the specific details of leaving, packing my bags, the drive to the airport in Paro, checking in or selecting my seat. What I will never forget is that my flight from Paro to Bangkok made an unscheduled stop in Calcutta. The elderly British woman next to me, we hadn't spoken until that moment, clutched my right arm with both hands. "We're not getting off," she said. I felt the bones of her fingers. She squeezed until my arm went numb. "If this is Calcutta," she said, "I can't do it again. Vow to me that you'll stay on board, that they'll have to use extreme force to get us off this plane." Her eyes watered as she searched hard into mine. I wanted to know more, but couldn't think of how to ask without intruding. "I promise you," I said, "our day won't end here." It was a promise I had no business making, yet needed to keep somehow. 20 minutes later, we lifted off again. We had only stopped for fuel, a stop usually made in Dhaka, the flight attendant explained, but that day our flight had been rerouted. The British woman wiped her eyes and thanked me, as if I had maneuvered the plane into the air myself. She took several deep breaths, put her right hand over her heart, and kept her eyes closed until we landed in Thailand. For weeks, I wanted to write a story that answered the questions I had been too polite to ask. What happened in Calcutta? What collision had demanded our brief connection? I never arrived at the right images and words. The story was not exactly mine to tell. In this book, I hope to collect stories that told me something I could not have imagined. I looked for prose where everything seemed connected, where a story accelerated even as it accumulated greater weight, where in the end the reader had experienced something more expressive than she or he would have imagined. One of my favorite questions in Neruda's The Book of Questions is, in what language does rain fall over tormented cities? Recently, I learned an alarming statistic from Words Without Borders. 50% of all books in translation worldwide are translated from English, yet only 6% are translated into English. In the United States, we export our language and culture with unrivaled vigor. In Bhutan, I met students who had watched television only once during their childhood at a community center the year Bhutan entered an archery team in the Summer Olympics. Still, as young men, they knew American music well and had watched bootleg copies of American movies brought into Bhutan from India. They were eager to ask me if Shania Twain was involved with Brad Pitt when she put his name in her song. I said no, and all day they insisted yes. Visiting Tibet, I cringed with the realization that a Backstreet Boys CD was playing on the sound system in a park across from the Potala Palace. If only the ringing of gongs that accompanies a Bhutanese dance or the vocal range of Tibetan monks chanting in debate could be equally disseminated across the oceans. It may seem absurd, but I resisted the reality that this book could not include the whole world. Several months into preparing it, I started talking into my sleep. Lebanon, I said. Bolivia, Armenia. I'd wake feeling anxious about cultures and settings that may not be represented here. I would remind myself that deeply affecting prose should speak to universal experiences, emotional landscapes as much as nationality and physical terrain. I'd relax only as I recalled what my friend, the artist Francine Matarazzo, once told me of writing fiction. Maybe you're not creating a map. Maybe you're creating a directory of the senses.
I love that. That was Stacey Bierlein reading from A Stranger Among Us, Stories of Cross-Cultural Collision and Connection. That was fabulous. And I had so many questions that came out of that reading. First of all, the notion that you were so concerned that or feared that you couldn't include every culture and every nation within the collection. Did you ultimately feel satisfied that that everybody kind of got their just due and kind of this human map was well represented?
Well, it's something I still worry about. I felt a little better when a review came out from the Utney Reader and said that was a modest apology, and the book actually did, make a reasonable attempt to represent the world.
Yeah.
My contract for this book was for 20 stories, and I delivered 30, and it was difficult for me to deliver only 30. For me, this book could have been much longer, although I know, the reading public maybe won't feel that way, because it is a hefty book at 30 stories. But I certainly couldn't have done it in less. And, like I said, this represents reading hundreds of submissions over 2 years. So, I do feel that certainly this is the best, that I could do in telling an emotional truth about where we are right now as a society and as a global community.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I suppose if you took a group of 10 people and you know, mined every story they had, you still couldn't create an entire map of
right
of everything,
right.
let alone the whole world. So
right,
that's,
exactly.
That's a
exactly.
lofty undertaking. And I also was really struck by this statistic that you had about the few number of books that are translated into English and the vast number are translated from English into other languages. What do you think that says sort of about the state of literature, the state of English-speaking nations vis-a-vis non-English-speaking nations?
Yeah, that statistic was really startling to me. And, you know, I think it represents, you know, a certain lack of interest in writers from other cultures. But I don't think that's true of the reading public. I think as a reading public, we are interested in those voices. And I just think the publishing world has been slow to respond.
Yeah.
I think we need to place a higher value on translated works. And, you know, just as a publishing industry, we need to do a better job getting those voices into our bookstores and into our curriculum. You know, certainly the universities do a great job of seeking these writers out, but I'm just not sure the New York publishing world is responding. And in a post-9/11 era, certainly we should be interested in these voices, and certainly we should, you know, want to make these ties with other cultures. So I think that, you know, I would like to see more translated works in the future. There are wonderful organizations like Words Without Borders
mm-hmm.
that are working, you know, on that very thing, on getting more of those voices into the American reading public.
Yeah, and it's it sort of underscores the assumption that everyone out there speaks English, and if they don't,
that's
they
right.
should. And
that's right. That's right. And you know, it is thrilling to be overseas and go into a bookstore and see some of the same titles and see that the people you're meeting
yeah.
are reading the same titles that you are. But the reverse of that, you know, I mean, imagine someone visiting from the Middle East and walking into, you know, a Barnes & Noble in Newport Beach. They
right.
wouldn't find very many authors that they knew.
Right, right. Very sad. Yeah, and you had also said in the introduction that you believe the book would, by definition, describe a post-9/11 world. And, you know, given the cover and the content description, I kind of thought that as well. But interestingly, it didn't feel that way much of the time. It felt... I don't know. I mean, it felt so kind of timeless in a lot of the stories. Did you feel the presence of 9/11 after the collection was assembled?
No. You know, I had the same experience that you're talking about, where the stories that referred to an era pre-9/11 had an emotional resonance that worked well post-9/11.
Yeah.
The very first story in the book, Spleen from Josip Novakovic, you know, he's been writing about the experiences of Croatians and Bosnians, you know, for over 10 years and well before 9/11. And this is a story that just really struck me as appropriate for any era in which it was read. I thought it was kind of a sharp story and a dangerous story that really appealed to me. The oldest story in the book is by a writer named Sadat Hassan Manto.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually passed away years before many of the contributors were born.
Mm-hmm.
But this story had a comic appeal that I really liked. Its satirical quality I really liked. And his work has only recently, you know, coming to us in English translation, but he's one of the most famous Urdu writers in history. So it was nice to have a work translated from Urdu. When I told a colleague of mine I was including translations, she assumed all of the translations would be from European languages. So so it's been nice to have works translated from Urdu and Farsi and have those taking people's attention as well.
Yeah, I was speaking with a translator a couple months ago, and a Japanese translator, and just what a job it is to try and convey all of the emotion behind individual words into a mindset that hasn't experienced that culture would just be such a job, and I so admire these translators and what they do.
Absolutely, absolutely. When you think about, you know, the job of translating poetry,
oh.
I mean, you know, even as a writer and editor, and you know, I've been working with words as my tools for so many years. I can't imagine the difficulty of that, of, you know, conveying an emotion in this compact way and being able to do, you know, to move back and forth between languages. There's a writer in the book, Francesca Marciano, and because I work mostly through her publisher and agent, I haven't been able to confirm this story with her, but the legend in the publishing world is that she wrote her book, from which this story comes, called Rules of the Wild. It's an extraordinary book, entirely in Italian, and then read it to her girlfriends, and they said, oh, it's wonderful, and she said, no, it doesn't sound right. Rhythmically, it's just off. It's not correct. And she went back and rewrote the entire book in English and represented it to her friends and said, now rhythmically I have it right in English, it works.
Amazing.
And I think that's incredible. And, you know, of course, it makes me wish I had learned five languages.
Right. That's amazing. And the other thing that struck me about some of these, I'm kind of thinking of The Naked Circus here and maybe Odalisque.
Yes.
Regardless of how universal and widespread gender issues are around the world, they're obviously felt much more acutely in certain nations, and to such an extent that I just wonder if it's ever possible to understand or grasp what women endure in some of these other countries. Has there been much discussion stimulated by the book relating to gender issues from the other cultures?
Well, because the book is so new, since the book has been out, I haven't encountered that a great deal. But I do expect that, and some of the writers I was drawn to, and some of the writers I asked to contribute to this book, I was drawn to because they spoke so well on that topic. Amy Liu, who contributed the foreword, for example,
mm-hmm.
Wrote a novel that dealt with human trafficking in India. And some of the things I've learned in talking to her are just incredible. We assume that human trafficking is, you know, largely due to Western exploiters, and there are stories of Nepali girls being abducted and taken to India to be part of the sex trade in India, and just to hear how widespread the problem is, it's really shocking, because again, it's something that, you know, we are allowed to be somewhat isolated from in the United States. Although that's not necessarily true either. I was in a program in Los Angeles where the speaker was a woman who had been abducted into sexual slavery in South Central Los Angeles. So that's, you know, certainly something that you know, that invites a lot of discussion and a lot of, I hope, healthy discussion. And the Western solutions to the problem, as Amy Liu touches on in her novel Flash House, the Western solutions to the problem aren't always correct. We often, as Westerners, want to go in and rescue these women, but sometimes they don't know what else to do. You know, if we're going to rescue them, we have to give them the resources to live a different life. You know, some women find that they have more power to better their lives working within the sex trade than outside of it.
Right. Amazing. Sadly, we're kind of drawing down on the time, but do you have any last words you want to share about the collection or about your work?
Oh, well, just that I certainly don't want to take credit for it on my own. It is the work of 30 writers and 6 translators and 7 associate editors. So it certainly relies on a lot of talents and not just mine. So while I'm the one who has the privilege to go out and speak about the book, I really want to celebrate everyone who was a part of it. And I hope readers respond to it really well. It's a publication that all of us who work together on it are so proud of.
Oh, and rightly so. And I'm sure this will enjoy a lot of success. It's just such an incredible collection.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
That was Stacey Berline, author of many things, but most recently editor of the collection A Stranger Among Us, Stories of Cross-Cultural Collisions and Connections, available now and published by OV Books. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Louise Erdrich will be with me for the second half hour, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at KUCI.org. Ellen Salalumin Amenti Alpha. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes public radio page or Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here now with Louise Erdrich. Louise is the author of 12 novels, as well as volumes of poetry, children's books, and a memoir of early motherhood. Her novel Love Medicine won the National Book Critics Circle Award. The last report on the miracles at Little No Horse was a finalist for the National Book Award. And were that not accomplishment enough, she also owns Birchbark Books, a small independent bookstore in Minnesota. But it's her most recent novel, The Plague of Doves, published by HarperCollins, that we will focus on this morning. Louise, welcome.
Hi. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
You know, there's so much to cover in this novel. And before we dive in, I was hoping for just a quick word from you on time management, on running a business, prolific writing in the midst of raising children. I'm wondering if you have some initial words of wisdom for other working mothers who write out there.
Oh, don't clean your house. Just let it go.
Let it go.
I have a very good friend who said that her mother had wonderful words of wisdom from Dorothy Day, and she just said, lower your standards.
I like that.
Lower your standards. Let go everything that's not essential.
I love that. Yeah, somebody else said, I think it was Grace Pally, who they asked advice from, and she said, just cheer up. So,
well, sometimes it's not possible to cheer up.
I
find that. I say thank you. I'm on the show, but I'm actually in the middle of one of these book tours where I have my daughter along, and I'm thinking about the book and thinking about so many different things. And So if we're interrupted by a seven-year-old, then I hope your readers, your listeners understand.
Oh, I've got one of those myself, so I'm all used to that.
Thank you.
So,
Thank you. So
tell us about The Plague of Doves, both the premise of the novel and how you came to it, how you became interested in writing it.
The book is really surprising to me because I've never written a book that I considered a mystery, and I didn't know I was writing it as a mystery. As I wrote it, I was escaping from a larger novel that I felt was more important, and I would get intimidated, and I'd go to this other book that I thought I could write in a smaller way and a more intimate way, and that became The Plague of Doves. I didn't know that it was going to have a beginning that needed to be solved by the end. So this book was a complete surprise to me in some ways, and really it was so satisfying because I had pieces of it that I was writing and enjoying, actually enjoying writing, while I worked on the other book. So I think it's wonderful when a novel comes to you like that, because most of them I've felt this huge were a huge task for me, but this one I loved the writing of it. It was the end when I had to put the pieces together and do the copy editing that I found, frankly, to be somewhat tortuous.
Yeah, it would be a challenge to construct, and I do want to talk about your approach to structure a little later on. It was funny because I began sketching a family tree about halfway through, and it was so convoluted and confusing that I finally, you know, kind of gave it up.
Should give it up. You know, I have many readers come up with family trees or come up with something they've constructed, and part of the books that I write is. Part of it is the confusion, and I think if you just allow the voices to carry you along, it'll be all right. Now, this is the way this is because I come from a large extended family, and people who come from large extended families kind of know how everyone's related, but they can't often
articulate it,
untangle the threads or articulate it. So that's in many ways, I think, why the books are the way they are.
And it also kind of underscored the premise that kind of the damage we do to each other, the harm we do, or you know, maybe the help we do to each other across generations is so, you're right, it is so convoluted and hard to track, and the threads kind of pick up here and get lost there, and the structure of it really lent to that idea, I thought nicely.
Well, I'll talk to you for a minute about the premise of the book because I think that will help listeners. I was haunted by the description, the historical description of a lynching of Native American young men. It took place in North Dakota, and it was a little known fact that Native Americans were also lynched. In this particular case, there was a 13-year-old boy. A child who was lynched by a mob for the murder of a farm family. Now, there were six people who were accused of this lynching. The others were exonerated. So basically, we know that they lynched innocent people, and this murder was never solved. The unresolved nature of a crime in a small community where there's a reservation and a off-reservation town where people intermarry, people mix together, people begin to live out the consequences of vengeance and retribution and not justice. The unresolved nature of this crime makes people act in ways they don't understand throughout the generations, I think. And so that's what the book is about. It's a lot of stories of people, different people. There's different narrators, and the people tell their stories. The stories all connect in the end. But as you're going through the book, I think there's some parts where, you know, you lose the connection, and then you pick it up again, and you lose it again, and you pick it up. But I think that's the way life is, and that's the way narrative is in life.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, many parts of the novel, I know, were published as separate short stories in a variety of publications. And it does have this feeling that you created sort of many points of light that relate together to form this constellation. And somehow I was even thinking of the Spoon River Anthology when I was reading this. Totally different book, obviously. But
very different, but in many ways a small community where people tell their stories. And in the end, these stories solve a mystery in the end.
Yeah, yeah. It was so nice. And as you talked about, the point of view shifts around, and you're so effectively, you had this kind of this feeling of getting to the story from all of these different people. Can you talk about how you chose your point of view characters? Because a lot of the action, the crime you talk about, aren't told directly from the point of view of the people who are witnessing it, but they were told through stories. And I thought that was such an interesting and effective way to do it. How did you choose your point of view characters?
I didn't really have a choice. They come to me. I hear the voice. I start writing the voice down. I really don't start out thinking, I'm going to use this narrator or that narrator. I'll keep things for maybe, you know, some of this has been in the works for about 20 years. I've had pieces that I just couldn't, I couldn't stop writing. Mm. So, you're talking about time management. I go in every day, if I can, into my room. I have a very cluttered little room that I write in, and I just sit down, and I see if anything's there, basically. I don't really know if I'm going to get somewhere with a story. I keep a long history of notebooks, and I'd suggest this for any writer who's listening. I write things down that it just hit me here and there. And I might hear a paragraph, I might hear a little description of something, and long after it will resonate and it'll turn into a story. It's as though it collects in a subterranean sort of way for me, and I don't even know that the story is collecting its power, and then it will turn out to be something that I can't stop writing. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really love writing, when there's something that goes on that I just can't stop doing, you know.
Yeah. And I know it's set in a place where you're intimately familiar. It's set in North Dakota, and you grow up in North Dakota as well?
I grew up in Wahpeton, North Dakota. And for any listener who lives or has lived in North Dakota, you'll know the terrain. Wahpeton is a wonderful small town, and I still love it. My parents still live there, and it's still a terrific, intimate place to live. I also am a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. Mm. So I have visited the reservation often and went there with my grandparents there and my family there and go back as often as I can. And right now I run a bookstore. I own a bookstore. I do not run it. I have to say, I do not do everything. I could never run a bookstore, but I really wanted to have this small bookstore as a place that would focus on Native writing, but also be for the larger community. I really believe that we need small independent or large independent bookstores. I believe we all need bookstores. But we need the libraries, we need the bookstores, we need the books, we need the narrative. And it's because we have this insatiable need for narrative that can you believe how much we need stories when you really think about the fact that we have to have movies, we have to have television, we have to have narrative in our lives. We live on it.
Right.
We feast on narrative, every one of us, in whatever form it is.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's beautiful. I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Louise Erdrich, author of many things, but most recently, The Plague of Doves. I also want to give you a chance to read to us from this, because it's well worth immersing ourselves in this for just a few moments. Would you mind reading to us?
No, I'd really actually love to. I'm going to read a small part of this because this part is about a violin, and it's about the way a man plays the violin, and it's about his music, and I think it is about art and about why we love art and why we love writing and why we have to have something that brings us into closer contact with the truths and the underlying emotions in our lives. And this is a man who's talking about Chamengua.
Mm.
Chamengua played the fiddle. How he played the fiddle. Although his arm was so twisted and disfigured that his shirts had to be carefully altered and pinned on that side to accommodate the gnarled shape, yet he had agility in that arm, even strength. With the aid of a white silk scarf, which he chose to use rather than just any old rag, Chamengua tied his elbow, ever since he was very young, into a position that allowed the elegant hand and fingers at the end of the damaged arm full play across the fiddle's strings. With his other hand and arm, he drew the bow. And here I come to some trouble with words. The inside became the outside when Chamengua played music, yet inside to outside does not half sum it up. The music was more than music, at least what we are used to hearing. The music was feeling itself. The sound connected instantly with something deep and joyous. Those powerful moments of true knowledge that we have to paper over with daily life. The music tapped the back of our terrors, too. Things we'd lived through and didn't want to ever repeat. Shredded imaginings, unadmitted longings, fear, and also surprising pleasures. No, we can't live at that pitch. But every so often something shatters like ice, and we are in the river of our existence. We are aware. And this realization was in the music, somehow, or in the way Chamengua played it.
Mm, that was beautiful. That was Louise Erdrich reading from her latest novel, The Plague of Doves. That's so pretty. I like this idea of music serving multiple functions in the novel. It's redemptive, and at times it's destructive. And those two notions are so tightly woven together that it's, again, it's difficult to see where one leaves off and the other begins. How did you regard the idea of music and the violin when thinking about structuring the book? Was it a very organic thing, or did it was it an intentional device?
It became more and more part of the book, and the violin itself that he plays with is a very old and very unusual. It's almost a creature, you know. Its sound is human. Its sound is like a voice, and it comes to him through a dream. I mean, there's a whole way this violin surfaces and resurfaces throughout the book, and the violin is ultimately the instrument of justice in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the violin became for me another character in the book.
Yeah. It's a beautiful device and beautiful symbol. You know, one of the things that I thought was so beautiful about this novel and your writing is that the language is often at odds with the content. There's beautiful language and beautiful imagery that's juxtaposed with, you know, some pretty horrific scenes. I'm thinking of the prologue as a good example, but there are other examples throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really striking. Can you talk about writing brutal or graphic scenes with restraint and beauty? Is that just kind of how you've evolved as a writer, or is it a really conscious attempt to put beautiful imagery against kind of horrific scenes?
Well, it took me about 20 years to approach this particular scene. I couldn't do it. I'm not made that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really what I understand as a person, and I have children, so it's very hard for me to write that sort of scene. I'm not a horror. I'm not a crime writer. Whatever you want to say, and yet this haunted me, and I felt that I had to write it somehow, and I had to write it in as restrained a way as I could. But the violin inserted itself, the beauty and the horror that was before me, I just tried to write in as simple a way as possible. I cut away many, many pages, and I also, you know, I made so many attempts. I can't even really remember how many revisions this book went through, because it's gone through so many over the years. So I pared away a lot, and I think that's how I was finally able to deal with it.
Yeah. And the other thing that was striking is there are a number of loaded symbols at work throughout the book, images that have, you know, carried enormous symbolic weight in religion or elsewhere, snakes and serpents and an apple just opposed with poisonous venom. And in other hands, it would be easy for these symbols to slip into the cliche, but that never happened here. And I'm wondering
because
I
love snakes, you know. Thank you for saying that it didn't slip into cliche, because the funny thing is, you know, I really don't think about symbols as they're being written. But afterwards I think, oh, I get it.
They were present on the page, and I thought, gosh, if somebody else was writing this, I just wouldn't buy it. But it never got to that. And so I was wondering if it was difficult to work with loaded symbols, and perhaps you answered it by saying you just love snakes. And if you...
Well, I do, you know, and I was thinking, I had to think a long time what snakes feel like and smell like, you know, and I was, you know, because my mother actually taught me that nothing alive is frightening. Nothing alive should frighten you. Everything alive is a good thing. So that my mother, this wonderful, reserved type of woman you wouldn't think would just say, yeah, don't be afraid. Just pick it up, handle it gently, and put it back, you know. So I knew a lot about what snakes feel like or what everything feel. You know, she just never was afraid of anything. I have this wonderful memory of her with a frog on her nose. The frog just sat there, you know. She just let it sit on a little frog. And she tipped her head back, and it just sat on her nose.
I love that, because I think that's exactly what I'm afraid of, is everything that is alive is exactly what frightens me. So maybe I should take your mother's advice,
Well, you know, I try to teach that to my kids, too, but there is one thing that it's hard for me to handle, and that's spiders. So I once went into a field with my daughters, and I said, because this field was filled with orb spiders, which are very large spiders, and they weave these beautiful webs, and I was going to teach them not to be afraid. And I went in with my daughters, and I said, see how beautiful this spider is. Look at its weaving. Look how intricate. And isn't it just a beautiful example of what's on Earth? You know, just let's just look real closely at it. She said, that is a nice spider, and it's just like the one on the front of your shirt. And I'm telling you, I looked down, I saw that spider, and I must have jumped back about 5 feet.
And then it bit you.
I don't know where that spider flew, but you know, I tried too, but I wasn't as good at it as my mother, I think.
That's great. Well, that's good advice, to use things that are just part of your, you know, everyday experience, that are part of your life, that have personal meaning for you, aside from whatever meaning they might have for other people, and maybe that pulls it out of the cliche. That's nice.
I don't know.
You know, sadly, we're drawing. These half hours go so fast, but I was wondering if you had any parting words or advice or.
Well, now I would just say to other writers or other women who are working on something that's meaningful to you, any art, that what you're doing is so important, to stay with it, to find your own space in your house, to love it, to honor it, cherish it, and make yourself a little time by, as I said, walking somewhere and leaving the mess behind for a bit.
Mm. Great advice. I'm going to go home and do just that. I'm just going to walk away from all my laundry.
I love that.
I love that. Louise, this is such a huge pleasure.
Thank you.
Huge pleasure.
Lovely
Thanks.
To talk to you.
Great
Take
to talk
care.
To you.
Bye.
That was Louise Erdrich, author of many things, but most recently The Plague of Doves, available now and published by HarperCollins. I also wanted to mention a few literary events that are taking place around town. First, Ray Bradbury is appearing at the Newport Beach Public Library on Thursday, May 22nd at 7 o'clock p.m. He is, of course, one of the rare individuals whose writing has changed the way people think, and this is a great chance to spend an evening with an American icon. Second, one of my future guests, David Benioff, author of City of Thieves and screenwriter for The Kite Runner, will be on the show on June 4th. Prior to that, David will be at Book Soup in West Hollywood this Sunday, May 18th at 4. He will also be appearing at Borders Books on Westwood Boulevard in L.A. on May 19th at 7:30 and reading at Vroman's in Pasadena at 7 o'clock p.m. on June 4th. So there are a few literary events happening around Southern California that you might want to check out. Speaking of Ray Bradbury, it is from him that I took a quote to end our time together today. First, find out what your hero wants, and then just follow him around. Ah, were it that easy. I'll be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with Sally Gunning, author of Bound, and we'll also be discussing the 6-word memoirs, Not Quite What I Was Planning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.